Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There are already legal challenges in the works after the Trump administration announced a new rule yesterday that could dramatically reduce and potentially end asylum for migrants along the southern border. The rule would bar migrants from applying for asylum in the United States unless they already tried to get asylum in one of the countries they passed through on their way to the U.S. Joining us now is NPR's Joel Rose, who's been following this story. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Jeremy.
So how does this work? Where will a migrant heading north from Central America have to now apply for asylum?
Right. Well, this is a sweeping new rule, as you say. It would require migrants to apply for asylum in at least one country that they travel through on their way to the U.S. before they get to the southern border. And so a migrant heading north from Guatemala would have to first apply for asylum in Mexico. A migrant from further south in, say, Honduras or El Salvador could theoretically apply in Guatemala or Mexico. But both of those countries have small asylum programs. Claims take a long time to process right now, and let alone if there were suddenly tens of thousands of new applicants. So under this rule, applicants would have to be denied asylum in one of these other countries before applying in the U.S. So in practice, advocates say this would effectively block most asylum claims from Central America.
Well, and also many migrants are fleeing for safety reasons, and maybe they don't feel that they would have the safety that they need in Mexico or certainly in other countries in Central America.
Yeah, no, that's a real concern. I mean, human rights advocates, immigrant advocates say that these countries are not safe places, and in some cases for their own citizens, right? I mean, we've seen hundreds of thousands of Guatemalans fleeing in particular because of poverty and violence in that country and heading north. And, Mexico has security challenges of its own.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, immigrant rights advocates don't think these Mexico or Guatemala are appropriate places for asylum seekers.
Now, the rules take effect today. Has there already been an impact or asylum seekers being turned away if they don't meet this new criteria?
That's a very good question. The Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice have not really talked about implementation and did not respond to our request for comment. So we're watching today to see what's going to happen at the border. I don't think it's likely that asylum seekers will be instantly turned away. I think it's more likely that they're going to have a chance to get what is called a credible fear interview before an asylum officer. Under the law, that is the first step in the asylum process. And until now, large numbers of migrants have been able to pass the credible fear screening because it's a fairly low bar. But that is likely to change. Reportedly, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which runs these credible fear interviews, has issued new guidance to the asylum officers who conduct them, essentially instructing them to reject most asylum claims under this new rule. And I think that's when you will start to see many of these migrants being deported after they've not passed their credible fear interviews.
And what is the Trump administration saying about the goal of this? Is it simply to reduce the flow of migrants, or what are they saying?
Yeah, I think that's it in a nutshell. I mean, to deter migrants from coming in large numbers and overwhelming the immigration system. In a statement, Attorney General William Barr said the rule will, quote, decrease forum shopping, unquote, by migrants who are trying to exploit our asylum system, his word. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan says the rule will get rid of, quote, a major pull factor, unquote. The administration believes that many of these migrants come here and file, quote, unquote, meritless asylum claims and then don't show up to court and disappear into the country. And the administration has been pushing Congress to tighten up the asylum law. That has not happened. And now the administration is essentially trying to change the law on its own.
So the ACLU's Lee Gelernt explained on Morning Edition today why his organization is now challenging this new asylum change.
Ultimately, this is an end run around Congress's decision to provide for asylum regardless of whether you transited through another country. At the end of the day, this is a separation of powers issue. Congress makes the laws about asylum. This administration doesn't like those laws, so it decided to rewrite them, but it cannot rewrite them unilaterally.
So add another case to the court's docket. We remember, of course, that the Democrats in Congress are trying to get a lot of members of the Trump administration to come and testify, and the Trump administration is saying no. That's all heading to court, too. Is this new rule, though, going to survive the legal challenges?
I'd say that's hard to predict. It's a similar case to one last year where the administration tried to take away asylum from migrants who crossed the border illegally, in other words, between the ports of entry. The administration also tried to make that change very quickly, just like this new rule. But a federal court in California blocked that one from taking effect because immigration law is pretty clear that asylum seekers can apply from anywhere in the U.S., regardless of how they got here. So it would not be a surprise if a court blocked this rule as well. Courts have blocked a lot of the administration's efforts to restrict access to asylum protections, and there have been many. But they've not blocked all of them. Some of them have gone into effect. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make a call right here.
Okay. That's NPR's Joel Rose. Joel, thanks.
Hey, you're welcome.
Well, the judge in the case of financier Jeffrey Epstein says he'll rule Thursday on whether Epstein will be granted bail while he waits for his trial on charges of sex trafficking and conspiracy. Epstein has been accused of abusing dozens of underage girls. He pled guilty to lesser charges in 2008 and served soft jail time for 13 months in a plea deal that enabled him to leave every day to go to his Palm Beach office. Earlier this month, he pled not guilty to these more serious charges, and a prosecutor said in court yesterday that more possible victims have come forward even since those charges. Renee Merle is covering the story for The Washington Post. Renee, two of Epstein's accusers were also in court yesterday. What did they say?
These two women told the judge that they want to keep Epstein behind bars until his trial. They used words like that he was dangerous, that he was scary. And they really got emotional talking about how they met Epstein when they were, one was 14 years old and the other was 16 years old. And they just talked about how he had really impacted their lives in a negative way.
That sounds very powerful. And of course, this story has kind of been moved from the headlines because of the president's tweets over the weekend. So many people may not have been hearing what, other victims may even be saying about why Epstein should be denied bail. As the women said, they didn't want to come across him?
Basically, yes. It was striking that, this has been a decade in the making, and this was our first opportunity to really face Epstein in a criminal setting. You know, he was able to arrange a deal, in 2005, 2008, mm-hmm. to settle state charges. And this is the first time that they got to face off of him in a federal and a criminal setting. Mm-hmm. And they called him, dangerous. And there's also this other issue that Epstein has a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And prosecutors are concerned that he'll be able to use that wealth to either flee or to obstruct justice by just paying off witnesses, potentially.
Because prosecutors are claiming that he did do that, that he sent money, or at least they say there's an A to B. There's a line of him sending money to potential witnesses.
Exactly. So the Miami Herald, which has really been on top of this story, wrote a big story. And a couple of days after this Miami Herald story, Epstein sent $350,000 to two people, an employee and a friend, who were potential witnesses, according to prosecutors, of his conduct. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying, though, even though that they haven't brought charges that he was trying to buy them off, they're certainly saying that there's a lot of smoke there, mm-hmm. and that's part of the reason that they wanted the judge to say no and not grant him bail.
And also, we understand that the government is also reporting that in a safe in Epstein's Manhattan home, there was cash and an expired passport under a fake name saying that he lived in Saudi Arabia.
This was really interesting. So prosecutors said just a couple of hours before the hearing, they found this locked safe. It has piles of cash, dozens of diamonds, and this passport that's expired from the 1980s, but it has a picture of Epstein, but uses a different name. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this kind of speaks to the prosecutor's concerns that if Epstein was let out of jail, that he would just get on one of his private jets and leave.
Okay. Well, he is asking, and his lawyers are asking, that he be able to what? We understand he says he would pay for round-the-clock security guards at his home.
Exactly. So he has a mansion in Manhattan, a couple of blocks from Central Park. It's worth either $50 million to $70 million, depending on who you believe. And he's saying that he would put cameras outside of that home, but also hire private security to be there with him at all times. And so the idea is that, you don't need to keep him in jail because, he's going to just be in that home at all times. It was a very unusual request. They even brought the head of the security firm to the hearing, and he was there to testify about what kind of services that they could provide for him, and said the guards could be armed or not armed, depending on what the prosecutors and the judge wanted.
Of course, the home is one of the most expensive in all of Manhattan. And it's reminding people that when Alexander Acosta was the prosecutor or the attorney in Miami, he brokered that deal in which Epstein was in a special part of the jail and actually was out of the jail for 12 hours a day in his Palm Beach office. So I'm sure people are thinking of that cushy plea deal at that time. Just very briefly, what happens next?
Well, tomorrow the judge is going to hold another hearing, and we expect him to give us a ruling on whether he's going to grant Epstein bail or not. You know, this is obviously a very critical matter. This trial could take months, if not a year, to go to trial. So he's looking at spending a lot of time waiting in jail for a trial, and it won't be like it was in Florida where he got to, you know, leave during the day to go to work.
Well, prosecutors have also said they've dramatically expanded the scope of the investigation. We'll keep hearing more about it. From Renee Merle of The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
Recently, dozens of women attended a salon of sorts hosted by Linda Pizzuti Henry, managing editor of the Boston Globe, among other things.
Well, thank you all so much. You are extraordinary women.
Wow!
That wow came from guest of honor, former senior advisor to President Obama, Valerie Jarrett. After hearing each attendee introduce herself, they included historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, former Massachusetts First Lady Diane Patrick, Ruth Poynter of the Poynter Sisters.
I'm almost speechless, and I'm never speechless. Thank you so much for coming out. Linda, thank you for hosting and for curating.
Then Jarrett spoke of her life story, as told in the memoir Finding My Voice, My Journey to the West Wing and the Path Forward, how her great-grandfather was the first black student at MIT, the country's first black architect, her father, a doctor who took a job in a pre-revolution Iran to end-run racist roadblocks in the U.S., Valerie was born there and lived there till she was 5. She then attended Stanford, Michigan Law School, quit a big real estate firm to work in Chicago city government, where she hired Michelle Robinson and befriended her fiancé, Barack Obama. It was a captivating talk. But afterwards, people like Democratic Congresswoman Lori Trahan wanted to know, what advice would Valerie Jarrett give to her party now?
When I think about the campaign and the administration that you all had, it was one of hope. What sort of advice do you have for us getting back to a hopeful place rather than divisiveness?
And that's where we later started our conversation. Again, this was last week before President Trump's recent racist tweets. Jarrett had been warning Democratic presidential candidates not to divide, wound each other, and has consulted with several. What are you telling them about, you know, you warned them, don't go after each other, but it seemed in the debates that they did?
I think that we are at an inflection point. I think that the current administration is eroding our social norms. And we can't afford to have whoever emerges as the nominee in the Democratic Party go into the general election in a weakened state. And so anything they say about each other will be turned into a commercial. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't hold each other accountable. I just think they need to be mindful of how their words can be used against them.
So what do you do about Kamala Harris and Joe Biden? I'm thinking you in particular. Here's Kamala Harris, a very strong woman. I'm sitting across from one. Joe Biden, your vice president, seemingly nostalgic about virulent segregationists and saying, well, you know, we worked well together. They didn't call me boy, seeming tone deaf to the fact that he's white and they probably still called black men boys. And we just had Nancy Pelosi tell four of the young progressives they didn't have any following. They're four people. That's how many votes they got. Ouch.
People are human. They're not going to all get it right every single time. We can be kind of messy at times. But the question is, are we casting any sort of mortal blows on one another? I feel right now, and the polling would indicate it, well, every candidate in the top tier of the Democratic Party would beat President Trump today. I want to keep it that way.
But do you think the progressives in the party are going too far to the left? The Republicans and Fox News having a heyday, talking about how in the debates the Democrats offered free stuff for everyone, free college, free health care.
All ideas that are consistent with our core values should be welcome. Are they all practical? Of course not. And you know what? I bet you some of the candidates say, actually, my thinking has evolved.
Barack Obama changing his mind on gay marriage comes to mind.
He said he evolved on it. And I love the fact that he sat down and had a thoughtful interview with Robin Roberts because he didn't want to just have a soundbite. He wanted to explain in the hopes that it might help other people do the same thing.
Do you think, Valerie Jarrett, that it's wrongheaded of the candidates to be talking about Medicare for All when the midterms were won on Obamacare?
I'm very proud of the Affordable Care Act. Is it perfect? No. I'm concerned that there's still parts of the country where there isn't enough competition, and so premiums are more than they should be. If you had a public option, that would introduce a little competition into the market. What can we do to lure private insurers into those markets? There's lots of ways of improving. I think when people say Medicare for All, it means different things to different people. Some people think we should have that as an option. Other people believe, well, we shouldn't get rid of the private insurance market because the vast majority of people have the benefit of private insurance. Let's debate the ideas and let's get away from socialism, even progressivism, labels that people don't really understand what they mean.
These are candidates who are claiming these labels. Are you saying they should drop them?
No, I'm saying that the people to whom they are talking should try to study what do they mean by that label.
Do you think the candidates should be explaining more what this means?
Yeah, and I think, as I said, it's so early.
You're watching so much of what the Obama administration did, the Paris Agreement, the Clean Air Act, the Iran nuclear deal, and the pecking away at Obamacare. What's that like to watch just about everything your administration did targeted?
So what troubles me about what's been happening isn't how I feel. It's about the people who have pre-existing conditions who are worrying about whether they're going to lose their health insurance. I worry about the families at the border who are being viciously separated from one another with no plan for how to reunite them.
I should say that the Obama administration did also have to separate at one point, but dropped that plan when it didn't work.
We only separated people who were not with their parents if we thought that they were in harm's way. We had, and this is an important point to make very clear, we did not have a policy of separating families at the border. And in fact, we released young children who were unaccompanied into the care of family members who were here in this country. We are appalled by the policy that was initiated by this administration that not only separated them, but had no plans of how to keep track of them so that they could reunite them. I worry about the fact that we forged an agreement with Iran to prevent them from developing nuclear weapons, and now they've signaled that they are moving forward. Why? Because the United States pulled out. All of that troubles me because of the people whose lives will be detrimentally affected by it, not because we work so hard to put it in place.
What do you think's going on there?
No idea.
Unraveling everything.
Well, everybody talks about China. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Act would have isolated China, and we would have had a huge trading bloc in the Far East. But I guess the point here is that elections have consequences.
You've said Barack Obama told you he doesn't like the direction the country is going in. What is he going to do about it? I mean, everybody's asking why he hasn't stepped up more for his vice president.
You'll have to wait to hear from him. But I think it's important that we not look to any one leader, but that we all recognize our own power. And we can't abdicate that responsibility and expect that somebody else is going to save us. We have to save ourselves.
Do people claim any responsibility? You know, I wish we had done this or this, or should we have paid more attention to the Tea Party? Now, a lot of it was ginned up, but the anger and feeling left behind sentiments that they were expressing, should we have been more in coal country?
I can tell you there are lots of things that I wish that we could have gotten done, but do I think that we ever for one minute forgot who we were there to serve? I certainly do not.
But letting them know that.
Well, it's challenging when you have institutions like Fox News blurring the lines between news and editorial. When you have social media, a lot of ways it brings us closer together, and it gives people who don't have a lot of resources the ability to say whatever they want to say, but we are left to decide what's fact and what is not. And one of the things I think early on I wish we had done a better job was to tell our story while we were trying to get the policy right on the Affordable Care Act. We didn't travel around the country and talk about all of the benefits of it. Why? Because we were trying to keep the economy from falling into a cliff. But you do have to figure out effective ways of getting people to appreciate that what you're doing is actually in their benefit. Initially, the Republicans were quite masterful, diabolically masterful, at politicizing it to the point where it was not popular. But now people were fighting to keep it. There was a consistent effort to try to undermine and discredit President Obama, even though the unemployment rate was cut in half, that 20 million people have health care who didn't have it before, that we brought 150,000 people back from war, that Osama bin Laden is not roaming around the world trying to wreak evil and hatred upon our country. I mean, there's so many different ways in which what we did strengthened America and kept us safer again.
Well, what's funny, Valerie Jarrett? You just put together a list that I'm not hearing from Democratic candidates.
Give them a chance.
I wonder when you are getting together with people from the Obama administration and you realize that there's a person in office, terrible things outside his marriage, who has lied. And here you had the first African-American first family, and there was never a hint of anything inappropriate. That's got to be galling.
Oh, you're talking about the double standard that we live under our entire lives, Robin. This is nothing new. This is why I think it was so important to both President and Mrs. Obama to ensure that we colored well within the lines. Of course there's a double standard. So I think it's a wake-up call for people who haven't lived the lives that we've all lived. But we knew there would be a different standard, and we also knew that it was important that they comport themselves at the highest possible level because they wanted to make sure the door was open for the next person who's a person of color. There's no margin for error when you're the first woman, the first African-American, the first Latina, the first gay person. You know that you are carrying a higher degree of responsibility. Is it galling? Sure it is. Are we used to it? Unfortunately. But I would rather comport myself with that high standard and be able to look in the mirror than to think that we had let down the American people. And that's not to say we were perfect. There are lots of things, if you get a do-over, you might do differently. But I can certainly say there is not a single day that we lost track of why we were there, and we did the best we could.
Valerie Jarrett, former senior advisor to President Obama.
It is Amazon Prime Day, the 36-hour shopping holiday with deals exclusively for Amazon Prime members. Amazon created Prime back in 2005, and it is a big part of why Amazon has been able to grow into the company it is today, which is worth more than $900 billion. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Jason Del Rey covers Amazon as a senior correspondent at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Jeremy.
So why did Amazon create Prime in the first place? It's almost feels like it's been around forever, but of course it hasn't. This is a membership program. What was the vision for it?
Well, initially, it actually just came from a frustration of a software engineer at Amazon who was sort of upset with the complicated software backend of their free shipping program at the time. But Jeff Bezos's long-term vision was to build a moat around Amazon's best customers and basically make it so they wouldn't think about the shipping fees each purchase, mm-hmm. but would think about how much they paid up front for Prime and so wanted to get their money's worth by buying more and more with Amazon.
So how has it evolved since it was first created back in 2005?
So over the years, one thing Amazon did was add more and more selection to Prime, which is a key, having that huge catalog. But they also added some free video back in 2010 or 11, then photo storage, then Prime Music, on and on to Whole Foods discounts now that they own Whole Foods. And so with all of those perks, the goal is really to just lock in Amazon Prime customers and have Amazon be sort of the default place to buy basically anything online.
And full disclosure, I am an Amazon Prime member, and I have never gotten more than maybe $2 off at Whole Foods, just to be clear about that. That discount is not very big. But it does cost money, obviously, to join Prime. Is the consumer psychology part of this working? Is it getting people to be more loyal to Amazon and not shop elsewhere?
Absolutely. And my disclosure is the same. I cover the company, but my family is also sort of sadly in some ways a Prime family. It does work. You know, Prime members spend more than non-Prime members do. Studies show they price compare much less. And Amazon, you know, often has very good prices, but not always. And Amazon has continued to grow their market share in online retail as Prime has grown in dominance as well. And so it's probably the most on one hand, the most successful internet loyalty program we've ever seen, but also the most devastating for competitors first and foremost.
Well, and how are they adjusting to this? We know that a lot of retailers right now during Prime Day are trying to offer their own discounts. But how is Prime in general affecting the rest of the retail industry?
Sure. So, I mean, everyone from Walmart to Target to even smaller retailers are realizing two-day shipping now online is basically table stakes. So being able to offer free two-day shipping. But even when you get to that point, Amazon goes and does what it announced a few months ago, which is we're moving Prime shipping from 2 days to 1 day. Mm-hmm. And so they have a 20-year head start on building out their warehouse network. And it's just really, really hard to catch up.
And just news alert to our listeners, it isn't free to ship something from China to Nashville. Okay, so that's not going to last forever. Jason Del Rey at Recode, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some of composer Alex Weston's haunting score for Lulu Wang's funny and poignant new film, The Farewell. Last week, we spoke with Awkwafina, who stars as Billy. Her parents move her as a child from China to New York. Then they all troop back to China for a thrown-together wedding, a pretext to say goodbye to Grandma without telling her she has terminal cancer, something that really happened in director Lulu Wang's family. The film's score, well, it underscores every moment. The soundtrack to The Farewell has just been released, and Alex Weston joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And what do you think of this story when you first were approached? It just sounds so wacky. It's much more than that.
I know. It's so much stranger than fiction. I remember hearing the story when it was on This American Life many years ago, and it really stuck with me then. So, you know, when I got called to meet with Lulu to talk about this project, it was really amazing. It's a story that really is unforgettable because in how personal and how unique it is to Lulu's family, it's impossible not to relate to it. You know, almost everyone's experienced loss or has a grandmother and can imagine what it might be like to lose one.
And as it says in the beginning of the film, based on an actual lie, let's listen to one of your tracks. It's called The Lie. Alex Weston, are you Chinese?
I am not Chinese, though.
Were you surprised that Lulu Wang asked you to do this? And did you have any, you know, second thoughts about, oh, wait a second, this is almost entirely based in China?
Well, we didn't, and this was a conscious choice, we didn't want the music to feel Chinese. The main sound of the score is very based in classical music, but like in a very like traditional sense. It was, you know, we used Vivaldi as the temp and Haydn and things like that. Because the story is so specific to China, we didn't want to pinpoint it just to that region.
Well, Lulu Wang has said she wanted a score with voices, a score that functions a bit like a Greek chorus, kind of a warning to Billy. And also, they would be the sound of community, because that's what this is about. She's going back to this tight-knit Chinese community, everybody keeping this secret from Grandma. You obviously have voices and a male soprano?
Yes, that was a very high tenor, a guy named Michael Kilgore.
And why? What were you thinking?
Lulu had the idea from the beginning, and we had many, many conversations about trying to find the right tone for this movie. And part of the thing with finding the tone was reflecting the importance and the drama of the situation while acknowledging that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, these stakes are relatively small. This is stakes that every family experiences. So when you hear a choir, you know, you have these – it's inherently very big and dramatic. And it kind of plays in a sort of not quite ironic way against what's going on in the picture when, you know, there's one moment in the film where we have sort of a big victory march and it's a choir, but everyone's saying, you know, do, do, do. And it's big and grand, but at the same time kind of funny and ironic.
Let's listen. So there are so many emotions that this music backs up. Pick another one.
There's a moment in the film after the family has an incredibly contentious dinner, and they're arguing and really criticizing each other about, you know, who chose to remain in China and who chose to go to America and, you know, what their identity means to them. And it's just – it's a very awkward conversation, and they're walking back to the hotel exhausted in silence, and the choir is you know, no one is speaking, but you have a full choir singing slowly and somberly.
Alex Weston, we know that in part of your career, you were an assistant to Philip Glass.
Yes, I was.
How does that help shape anything we're hearing here?
I mean, I'm not sure if musically, I mean, of course, working with Philip, you know, it's gotten me into the room for projects that I probably wouldn't be able to otherwise. And these are experiences where, you know, when I'm doing my own projects, I'm a lot more comfortable. I know more what I'm doing because, you know, I've cut my teeth with people who've been doing it for a long time and have a lot more experience doing
it.
And musically, even if my writing isn't structured the same as Philip or stylistically the same, he has this fantastic way of using harmony and really taking advantage of the material that he has and, you know, taking the patience to really develop it and get the most emotional impact out of it. And that's something that I try to involve in my own writing.
Well, back to the score for The Farewell. You also include songs, there are three of them, including a beautiful version of Leonard Cohen and Patrick Leonard's Come Healing, performed by Elena Boynton. Let's just listen to a little.
Behold the gaze of mercy and arbitrary space, and none of us deserving the cruelty or the grace of solitude of longing.
Using the song is something that Lulu had in mind from the beginning, though it did seem kind of jarring to have all of a sudden in this movie that is very feminine focused to suddenly have like this really grovelly Leonard Cohen. So we wanted to re-record it with a female singer, though find someone who had that kind of low voice that kind of could do this sort of voice of God sort of quality. So I did the arrangement and orchestration for the song and worked with Elena on it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Lulu Wang. She is a musician. In a sense, was a pianist before she became a filmmaker. And she performs on another piece, Caro Mio Ben. Hera Haiseng Park singing, Lulu Wang, the director, playing. Let's listen. What was that like to work with a director who is also a musician?
It was really phenomenal, actually, to be able to work with a director who was able to give me really specific feedback. And Lulu was a very particular and very focused director in getting what she wants, you know, as opposed to sometimes I've worked with directors in the past who have sent cues and they'll say, like, can you take out the saxophone? And you'll be like, well, this is a string quartet. I'm not sure what to do here. And that was an issue I never encountered here.
Alex Weston, again, the film The Farewell is getting a lot of attention, but we're drawing attention today to the music because it's really lovely. And then, after the surprise ending that we're not going to give away right before the credits, Senza di Te, performed by Fredo Viola, which we all know as I Can't Live If Living Is Without You.
Il cuore batterà nel buio. Per chi io vivrò, per chi sorrirà.
she said.
What was the thinking here?
There's like a couple scenes of karaoke in the movie, and Lulu, because of the karaoke in that, and also because of what we were saying before about the choir being this sense of community, she wanted it to end with karaoke. You know, he drops away and it's just Lulu and I think about 10 or 15 friends after about a shot or two of tequila. That is the end of the credit song.
Composer Alex Weston, what can we end on here? What's a moment that touched you in this film?
There's a motif in this movie that we referred to as the lie theme as we were working on it, which we played earlier in this interview. And the theme comes back in various forms throughout the movie. And there's a dramatic action towards the end of the movie, which Billy has to undertake to make sure that the lie stays a lie and Grandma doesn't find out. And it is the culmination of the lie theme. On the soundtrack, that's a cue called Billy.
Composer Alex Weston, his music can be heard on the new film, The Farewell. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And stay for the credits.
This summer marks 20 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that people with disabilities cannot be unnecessarily kept in institutions. The Olmstead decision, the result of a case from Georgia, said the physically challenged deserve to live their lives in their communities. But that's a promise that comes with a lot of different costs. Sam Whitehead of WABE reports.
By late morning, it's getting hot in Lisa Archibald's garage, even with the big door pulled open. She points a whirring box fan at her brother, John David Mixon. He sits in a wheelchair and watches the occasional car pass by their home in the small town of Byron, Georgia. Archibald says, these days, she's tired.
I can go 72 hours at a time without taking more than a 20-minute cat nap on the sofa or in the recliner.
Archibald spends much of her time caring for her brother. He's 35 and has cerebral palsy and a condition where his brain developed too many folds. You won't hear from him because he can't speak. Archibald just can't find enough nursing help and picks up the slack herself.
He gets changed every 2 hours. He gets meds, some type of medication or intervention 26 times a day.
All that work has kept Archibald from keeping a full-time job, and she says it strains her family relationships. Archibald says her brother spent 6 years in a state institution after their parents died. Now, she worries that she's running out of options, and he may have to go back.
It's seriously at the point now to where I have to sit down and decide, am I going to lose my home? Am I going to lose my fiancé and save him, or do I save myself?
It's been 2 decades since the U.S. Supreme Court said in Olmstead that people like Mixon don't need to live in institutions to get services, and that they deserve to get community care. Susan Goyko is with Atlanta Legal Aid.
It's been a slow process here in Georgia, I would say. There was not a light switch that flipped on and everything was perfect.
Goyko says in the years immediately after the decision, Georgia officials formed a blue ribbon task force to decide how the state would comply. That gave way to an Olmstead planning committee.
There were a lot of planning meetings, I would say. But not a lot of action and not a lot of funding that is necessary to build an appropriate community service system.
Things went so slowly, the U.S. Department of Justice sued Georgia. In a 2010 settlement, the state agreed to provide more chances for people to leave institutions and more oversight of that process. But Goyko says there's still work to be done. By one count, thousands of people sit on waiting lists for state programs that pay for care, she says.
That's just not acceptable. To me, it's an issue of having some urgency about this, recognizing that it's a civil right for people. It's not optional.
A lack of spots in community programs is a common problem, says Bob Dinnerstein. He runs the Disability Rights Law Clinic at American University.
That's challenge number one, how to make this enough of a priority so that a state and the legislature and the governor don't just say, well, it'd be nice if we can do this, but rather say, no, this is really an imperative.
This year, Georgia lawmakers funded 125 new slots in a program for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. That program currently covers more than 12,000 people. But each state is different. Dinnerstein says some have expanded services more than others, and those in the South tend to put less money into programs than states elsewhere.
It's a step forward, it's a step back, two steps forward. It's not completely haphazard, but it's certainly not a consistent story.
That points to larger issues, says Sarah Rosenbaum. She teaches health law and policy at George Washington University.
In trying to implement Olmstead, you then suddenly see the problem for what it really is. The problem is there aren't enough services.
Rosenbaum says Olmstead was transformative, a civil rights decision along the same lines as Brown v. Board of Education. But the more time passes, she says, the more Olmstead exposes holes in the U.S. healthcare system.
We do not have a long-term services and support system in this country, whether it's a family with a child who needs complex care, or whether it's, you know, an 85-year-old woman trying to stay in her own house.
Georgia's Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities has launched several initiatives to build that workforce. In the meantime, people like Lisa Archibald fill the gaps. She stretches herself thin to care for her brother, John David Mixon. We walk inside, and Archibald shows me what used to be her living room. Now it's got Mixon's hospital bed, his IV stand, a shelf of supplies.
I do it because I love him, and he is a person who absolutely deserves the same things that everybody else does.
That's the promise Olmstead offers, but it comes with costs. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead.
Well, as we close out this hour, one more news item we're following. Robin, the Emmy nominations are out, and Game of Thrones leads the pack with 32
9,033.
Exactly. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel got 20. Bodyguard, also up for Best Drama, along with Killing Eve, Better Call Saul, Game of Thrones, This Is Us, Ozark, Pose, and Succession. And on the comedy side, Veep, Barry, which I finished last night, which
yes,
is so good.
Love.
Fleabag, The Good Place, Mrs. Maisel, Russian Doll, and Schitt's Creek, S-C-H-I-T-T-S. Got to say that every time. The Emmys are September 22nd.
And everyone got nominated.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.